Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The recent tragic events in Israel and Gaza have thrown up a host of questions that have complex political and historical backgrounds. And since three major world religions are involved, some demanding theological issues as well. Proponents of both the left and the right have engaged in loud and vigorous and increasingly toxic public debate over the rights and wrongs that lie behind the history of Israel and Palestine. The politics of Israel depend upon a complicated balance of secular Israeli power politics and nationalism at one end of the spectrum, and Orthodox Judaism at the other. But the politics of Hamas and what are generally agreed are their paymasters in Iran are informed by Islam and their interpretation of Islamic values. And as the scale of Islamic immigration into Europe intensifies, the struggle between Islamic culture and Islamic practice and their host communities is developing with some speed. Part of the difficulty we face is that it's becoming more clear in our own national public discourse that few people have much understanding of Islam, its priorities, its theology, and its history. Christian Concern is an organization that defends those who find themselves silenced, censored, or sacked for wanting to observe Christian principles or exercise what, until recently, was understood to be a degree of free speech. Tim Diep works as head of public policy for Christian Concern. He's an author of some significant books that contribute to the present debate, and he has a wide experience in the challenges posed by secularism, the sexual revolution, and Islam. And he joins me now. Tim, thank you very much for joining me. We're old friends and colleagues. It's especially nice to have you on this part of this conversation. You come with about as much experience as almost anybody I know of the difficulties that Christians find themselves in as they face two principal, I suppose we probably should use the word antagonists, but let's say competitors for the moment. Mm-hmm. And they are secularism and Islam.
Yes.
Could you begin by telling us a bit about Christian Concern and then why you're there and why are competitors of secularism and Islam boast with, I don't like the word, but we'll use it, robust ideologies, find Christianity so an anathema to them and why they want to close it down? Because I think for a lot of people, the religion, the philosophy, the virtues of nice kick in. And as long as people are nice, they can't possibly be in the grip of malign forces, energies, or ideologies. But I think life's more complicated than that. How complicated does it look from Christian Concern? Why are you there and what are you doing?
Thank you very much, Gavin. Well, yes, I work for Christian Concern. I've worked here for about 7 years now. I joined actually to focus on Islam initially, and there's a kind of story behind that, which maybe we should get into. And we're most well known really for our legal cases. You may have seen the case of Sadiq Shah, originally known as ST because of a very draconian gagging order on her case. She was a conscious 19-year-old girl and fully corpus mentis. Doctors said, we want to move you on to palliative care. And she was like, no, I want to keep fighting. I want to keep fighting as long as I possibly can. And in spite of two psychiatrists ruling that she's perfectly capable of making her own decisions, the judge ruled that no, she can't be competent. She must be delusional because she doesn't believe what the doctors are saying. A lovely Christian girl. I mean, it's an awful judgment and has very disturbing consequences. In the end, she died separately from a heart attack. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that we get involved in. And then we've also got cases like a teacher who refused to teach sexualizing education lessons, LGBT propaganda stuff, and risks being struck off from the teaching regulation authority. We've had a couple of these now where it's not just we want to sack you, it's also we want to stop you from ever working again. Now, if you object to this ideology, if you're prepared to stand up against it. And in relation to Islam, you know, street preachers are very often where we end up involved there. And there's a very well-known street preacher called Hatun Tash, who is very, very brave and courageous in tackling Islam. And she's been wrongfully arrested several times, but also assaulted and knifed a couple of years ago in a clearly an attempt to kill
her.
And
she's an ex-Muslim.
And she's an ex-Muslim, and she's seen hundreds of Muslims convert to Christianity and even, I think, 100 imams as well. I mean, very, very effective by being very blunt. I mean, saying Islam is wrong and Muhammad is a false prophet and all this kind of stuff, which is kind of what you need to be, I think, to challenge. And the Muslims are not used to that. And this is what gets them thinking and sometimes converting.
If I can just stop you for a moment, because this is a very interesting train of thought. But it's not just the Muslims who find this difficult. Secular society finds it difficult when Christians make an objective judgment about the authenticity of something like Muhammad the Prophet, and have managed to smuggle this discomfort into the law under the guise of Islamophobia.
Did you call Muhammad the Prophet there, Gavin? I'm shocked that you said that.
Well, just, I don't care about being shocked. I will stay out of jail. But they've introduced Islamophobia as a concept, which just makes it very difficult even for you and I to have a conversation without being careful.
Well, lest... this is the problem with all these phobias, Gavin, is that the intention and the result is to shut down debate. Instead of engaging with rational argument, they will just call you transphobic, homophobic, Islamophobic, or something else phobic. And that's the end of the discussion. And, you know, and there's no further discussion to be had. And that means there's no rational debate and discussion that you can have with people, because they just label you and insult you and then refuse to engage in argument.
Why aren't they Christianophobic? Because if this was really was an even-handed debate, Christianophobia would be part of it, but it isn't. Why not?
Well, I don't want it to be, Gavin. I don't want to claim victim status. I don't want to promote phobias. I don't want to encourage everyone to claim phobia status.
I mean, I know you saw
there was a report that came out from Civitas a couple of weeks ago about Islamophobia, and it reported on various councils that have adopted this definition. And in a Scottish council, somebody claimed that they'd been called an Anglophobic, or they'd been insulted as Anglophobic. And they wondered whether they ought to accept a definition of that. I mean, where does it end? You have unending phobias if you go down this line. I'm not keen on promoting Christianophobia. Anti-Christian is fine. Anti-Muslim is fine. Let's use those terms rather than this vague and elusive and insulting phobia as thing.
So I agree completely. And thank you for saying that. So energetically, that's quite right. We want to avoid the whole ideology of phobia, which is based on wholly improper psychological categories. What I was trying to do was to ask you to comment on the fact that it appears to be a movement of fairness and inclusion, but it's not fair because it's anti-Christian and it excludes Christians. What's the motivation for this whole victim bestowing debate, which includes everybody but Christians?
I can't help thinking the motivation is to shut down debate, is to not allow people to criticize these ideologies, which includes the whole LGBT thing, lesbian, gay, transgender, etc., and the whole Islam thing as well, and, you know, transgenderism as well. If you so much as raise a query about these things, they just call you transphobic and that's the end of it. I mean, they're done, and that's the end of the argument. And I think that is a real issue here.
We have a very interesting voice called Bishop Fulton Sheen. And one of the things he said in the first half of the 20th century was that Christianity faced two enemies, one from inside and one from outside. The one from inside was Marxism, because it's a form of Christian utopianism that has become secularized, and it uses many of the categories of Christianity in a secular and political context. And on the outside was Islam, which some people see as a Christian heresy. But they both use force in a way that Christianity is set up not to use force. It's a matter of invitation and the will, although from time to time, Christian organizations have been corrupted and used it. But the difference between Islam and Marxism, on one hand, and Christianity, is that they're very happy to use force and also happy for debate to be closed down. Can you talk a little bit about the will to power of both these competitive ideologies and the way it's used?
Sure. Well, let's start with Islam, shall we, Gavin? The moment you see things like we've seen in the news this week, lots of people bring out this trope, Islam is a religion of peace. I did an article about this, is Islam a religion of peace? In fact, if you Google that phrase, is Islam a religion of peace, my article comes in like the top five results. It's been read by many thousands of people. But to sort of cut to the chase, let's be clear, I'm talking about Islam and not Muslims, right? Most Muslims are peace-loving people, and let's leave it at that. They're peace-loving people, and that's what they want, and they're genuinely peace-loving. But Islam as a religion, well, if you judge it by its teaching, or if you judge it by the example of Muhammad, or if you judge it by the history of the religion, how it's expanded, it's violent, right? It espouses violence. It teaches violence. Muhammad's example is violent. He fought in many, many battles. And the history of Islam is expansion by the sword. And so this is very much baked into Islamic teaching. And so this is why you get Islamic radicals who are willing to use force and terrorism and all this for the expansion, because they're going back to the text, they're going back to the example of Muhammad, they're going back to the history, and they're saying this is the way to do it. And so you get Hamas, whose motto says the Quran is our constitution, jihad is our way, and death in the cause of Allah is the highest thing we can do. And very much, you know, we're on the Quran, we're doing jihad. This is a clearly religious motivated thing. And you get terrorist attacks, like perhaps most recently in the UK, the assassination of Sir David Amess. And I found it absolutely shocking, Gavin, that the debate in Parliament was about social media, as if that had caused it, when the killer himself had cited the Quran and said he was motivated by expanding Islam. But everyone ignored that, so better not talk about that. But they talked about social media instead, as if that was the cause, and it clearly was not the cause. Islam was behind it very, very clearly. And in this case, in Hamas, very, very clearly, they state it in their own words. Islam is absolutely their constitution and what they try and do. And they're very motivated by that. And violence is clearly how they read it in the text. And it's difficult to get away from that when you actually read the text yourselves. And I refer you to that article, Is Islam a Religion of Peace?
It's a very good article. I've read it. And I was one of the first things I discovered I didn't know was that the idea of Islam as a religion of peace was a propaganda tool introduced only in the 20th century. In the previous centuries, the phrase wasn't used. It wasn't even thought to be useful. It does seem to me as though there's a form of social contagion that we're in the grip of. This is difficult to talk about, really, but it seems to me there's a kind of willful blindness in the same way that one puts off opening a bank statement or tries to ignore something that needs dealing with because the difficulty of dealing with it would be so testing and so problematic. It seems to me that our culture and our society doesn't want to entertain the possibility that Islam does use force and is predisposed to use force. And if that's raised, the first thing we get is the whataboutery argument. Well, Christians have used force, the church has used force, Crusades and Inquisition. But my understanding is that when Christians use force, one can refer them to the Gospels and say, this is not what Jesus intended. You're being bad Christians. You need to turn around and be better Christians and not use force. But you can't do that with Islam. There's nothing in Islam that allows us to say to the would-be terrorist or the activist or the Islamic evangelist, force is improperly Islamic. Can you explain a bit about that?
There's no separation of church and state in the case of Islam, whereas there is a rich tradition of that in Christianity, going back to the Old Testament as well with the prophets and the kings. And so they very much see, you know, Islam is a political as well as religious ideology that you know, is not afraid to use force in that way, as we said. And so, yes, they're going back to that, whereas Christianity separates these two, or should separate these two, the state and the church. And their Christianity is not therefore political, it's spiritual. You know, we're trying to advance the spiritual kingdom rather than a political kingdom. And that's a key difference. And obviously the example of Jesus, I mean, he never killed anyone, he never enslaved anyone, he never raped anyone, all these things, whereas Muhammad did. And so there's your striking contrast. And obviously I always try and point this out when I talk to Muslims, why would you follow Muhammad when you can follow Jesus? Not least by the way he treated other people, but also not least because Jesus rose from the dead and Muhammad didn't.
I've also found that one of the most helpful ways of having a conversation, if you have to discuss Islam or Christianity, they're both such enormous concepts that they're difficult to do justice to. But if you want to discuss the differences between them, then talking about Jesus and Muhammad as people is a useful way forward.
Briefly plug my book there, Gavin, written with Beth Peltzler as well, called Questions to Ask Your Muslim Friends, which give lots of ideas along these lines.
But tell us a bit about the book, Tim, because it's a very good book and it needs more than plugging.
Well, thank you. So we really feel like lots and lots of Christians don't know where to start when talking about faith issues with their Muslim friends, and therefore they shy away from talking about it, where Muslims are not actually afraid to talk about faith issues and are quite bold and upfront about it. So we just wanted to really give some Christians some clues and ideas about how to start these conversations. For example, you can ask your Muslim friend how they became a Muslim. You can ask them what difference prayer makes in their life. You can ask them how they became a Muslim, or you know, how they examined the truth of Islamic claims and things like that. And then you can go into exactly what we've just been talking about, comparing Muhammad to Jesus. Why would you follow Muhammad when you can follow Jesus? And exactly those kind of areas. And then it goes into a bit more depth about questions you can ask about Islamic teaching, things that the Quran says, you know, what's your reaction to the Quran having all these violent verses or these verses about women and so on. Because most Muslims don't know actually what the Quran teaches. They're not encouraged to read it for themselves in their own language that they can understand. They're not encouraged to ask questions about it. That's seen as kind of culturally offensive. Whereas Western Muslims that are taught in school do understand the idea of rationally examining things, asking questions. So if you encourage them to do that about their faith, you can provoke them to re-examine where they are and why they believe it.
Tim, I found reading the Quran quite difficult. I've got a bit of Greek, and so I understand the New Testament a little. I got taught a bit of Hebrew, which I loved, and found the experience of reading the Old Testament in Hebrew, as far as I got, enervating. I find Arabic and the style of the Quran quite impenetrable. And it may be that it's a Western mindset I have. But even when I sit down to read the Quran, as I do quite often, I find it has a kind of an elusiveness that it's not remotely the same as the New Testament or the Old Testament.
Well, you're not the only one to find that, Gavin. I mean, many people have said that. And it's been said that the Quran has no actual complete story in it that goes from beginning to end, has a conclusion. It is quite impenetrable. It's quite hard to read. It also, it's not in chronological order. It's just in the order of the length of the surah. So you get confused about what's where, when's what. And there's a jumble of stories in there and jumbled messages and things. It isn't coherent. The Bible is very coherent and clear and roughly in chronological order as you read through it. And also, you know, genre as well is separated out clearly in the Bible. It's not the case in the Quran, and it is difficult, and it require an interpreter really to understand it. And that's a difficulty that many people have recognized.
One of the things I've discovered talking to Muslims is that although there's a tradition of exegesis in Christianity, the capacity for interpreting Quranic verses, and in the end, always the issue is, well, unless you read this in Arabic, we're not dealing with the inspired word anyway. It's something that's quite hard to get beyond. I'd like to ask you to tap your expertise on anti-Semitism, because this conversation is taking place in the context of the dreadful events in Gaza, and we've got a tit-for-tat going on, and the world is divided into those who look at the Palestinian cause and without understanding the claims of Israel to go back 2,500, 3,000 years, they prefer the Palestinians' claim to be the indigenous people. So they both have claims, whether they're equal or not, it's a matter of judgment. The Jewish community has always said since 1948, we are willing to come to some form of compromise in order that we can live together. And my reading of the political history of the Middle East is that that's been stymied by the Palestinians and other Islamic parties saying, we're absolutely determined to eradicate Israel, and we don't believe you have the right to exist, and we're going to work to eradicate you. Now, this political piece of given history doesn't seem to find its way into the public account very much. You don't hear journalists talking about it. Jews talk about it, saying it's not much fun living under a barrage of rockets as there is a permanent, non-stop attempt to get rid of us. Can you talk a bit about the antecedents of the anti-Semitism? I think we have to describe it as a hatred of Judaism, a hatred of Jewishness, and a hatred of the state of Israel. Why Muslims are so completely implacable in a way that in any other context would be thought of as totally unreasonable?
Well, anti-Semitism in Islam goes straight back to the Quran and straight back to what Muhammad himself taught and did. I mean, Muhammad was clearly anti-Semitic. Jews are described as pigs and apes and subhuman creatures in Islamic teaching, Islamic, you know, holy texts and so on. And it's deeply anti-Semitic. You know, a recent survey of anti-Semitic attitudes in the UK, prevalence of anti-Semitic attitudes is about 10-11%. Amongst Muslims, it's 54%. So yeah, they do absorb this kind of anti-Semitism there. The Hamas Charter quotes from Hadith. Those are widely respected and viewed as authentic and viewed as spiritually binding quotes from Muhammad. There's one here that says the time will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews and kill them, until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, "Oh Muslim, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come on and kill him." You know, obviously virulently anti-Semitic stuff there. That's in the Hamas Charter. I'm quoting the Hadith there that says that, that is regarded as an authoritative Hadith. You know, and then you've got people chanting on the streets of London, "From the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free," which is clearly anti-Semitic chant in the sense of wanting to, you know, rid the whole area of the state of Israel at all, and ultimately really rid the whole area of Jews completely. And so people are aware that people who are chanting that slogan do not want a two-state solution, do they, Gavin? I mean, that is not a two-state solution slogan, right? That is like, we want to wipe the whole lot out. here. And again, the Hamas Charter says there is no solution to the Palestinian problem except by jihad. The initiative proposals and international conferences are but a waste of time and exercise in futility. That's a direct quote from the Hamas Charter. Again, the Islamic Resistance Movement believes that the land of Palestine has been an Islamic waqf, that means Islamic holy land, given to Muslims throughout all generations until the day of resurrection. No one can renounce it or part of it or abandon it or a part of it. No Arab country, or not the aggregate of all Arab countries, and no Arab king or president, nor all of them aggregate, have that right, nor has any right of any organization, be they Palestinian or Arab, because Palestine is an Islamic waqf throughout all generations and to the day of resurrection. So this is a very deeply religious conviction that the land belongs to them, and the hatred of the Jews is very much part of it. The anti-Semitism is very much ingrained in this whole thing and spilling over onto the streets of London. And I was very, very shocked, Gavin, that, you know, three schools closed in the UK. I mean, isn't it so shocking and disturbing that Jews don't feel safe to go to school in the UK? I think that's very, very disturbing. And the massive rise in anti-Semitic incidents. But what nobody's saying is it is Islamic anti-Semitism. It's not anybody else that's behaving anti-Semitically. It's Muslims who are doing it, and it's sparked off by this whole Gaza war. And it's because we've, you know, massively increased immigration of Muslims into the country. Surprise, surprise, we're seeing a massive increase in Islamic attitudes, which includes anti-Semitism.
I think one of the things that people have yet to catch up with is what the implications are of mass immigration. At the moment, we're finding that parts of the country have become Islamified. And I was lucky enough to have some Muslim friends, particularly during a period when I was involved in conversations between the three Abrahamic faiths. And I was very surprised to discover that they had ambitions to turn the UK into an Islamic Republic. And although their numbers were quite small at the time, I was told, in fact, and I don't know if this is true, treated as apocryphal, that actually some Muslim leaders had approached Tony Blair and asked for a number of northern cities where Muslims were or would soon become the majority to be handed over as to be run according to Islamic culture, customs and rules. In terms of the notion of the Islam dividing the world into the world of Islam and the world of war, what are the ambitions of Muslims in Europe? And is immigration, mass immigration, more than just providing people to come and pay the pensions that we've incompetently failed to pay ourselves for the future?
Well, there is an Islamic doctrine of migration in order to Islamicize cultures based on Muhammad's migration in his lifetime. And so there are Muslims who will think like that. And I think there's a minority of Muslims that really think like that, because I think it's not well known in the Islamic community. But nevertheless, there is that there, and there will be Muslim leaders who are thinking like that. And like I said, Gavin, Islam is a political ideology as well as a religious one, and it will have political ambitions, and it will seek to influence the politics wherever it goes. And I was reading this week what 31 constituencies held by Labour MPs with predominantly Muslim communities, of which 17 are represented by front benches. They're very worried about Keir Starmer supporting Israel, because Muslims are very upset about that. This is therefore affecting democracy already here in this country. And the Labour Party is not wanting to upset the Islamic community by supporting Israel at all in the current conflict. And some Labour councillors have already quit in protest at what Keir Starmer has said about this. And as you probably know, Gavin, every major political party, with the exception of Conservative, have accepted or formally adopted the APPG, or British Muslims, definition of Islamophobia, which is very, very vague and perceptive in its definition. It defines Islamophobia as a type of racism in spite of Islam not being a race, and it says that it's against expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness, which basically means if anybody perceives that what you're saying is Islamophobic, then it is Islamophobic by definition. And we had Trevor Phillips suspended from the Labour Party over some things that he had said. We've just recently had a Labour councillor suspended from the Labour Party for some tweets that were deemed Islamophobic. And Labour politicians know very well that they don't say anything criticising Islam, because if they do and they're accused of Islamophobia, they'll be suspended or disciplined or expelled from the party. So you've got a de facto Islamic blasphemy system there across political parties, apart from the Conservative Party, which is very, very concerning. And then also something like, is it 1 in 17? I can't remember the statistic now, of councils, 1 in 7 councils, I think it was, that have adopted it across England, and 1 in 4 in Scotland and 1 in 5 in Wales have formally adopted this definition as well. So we are getting to a place where we're quite close. Labour have said they want to bring in a Race Relations Act about racism, given that they've formally adopted this definition of Islamophobia, which defines Islamophobia as a type of racism. That act will probably include that definition of Islamophobia as a criminal offence. And then you've got, that is it, then you've got an Islamic blasphemy law. That's how close we are today to having an Islamic blasphemy law in this country.
That really is incredible. And for those of us who are dedicated to free speech and the free exchange of views, it's very threatening. One of the things I was surprised at was to discover how many Islamic mayors there are in the country. I didn't know that we had the number of MPs have reached the state it has. Is there going to come a point where we can expect an Islamic party? I mean, does it depend on what proportion of the population become Muslim? I'm thinking particularly, really, of the situation in the 1930s in Germany, where democracy was lost because I think about 12% of the population supported one party. And if you can deliver 12% of the votes of the population, let alone those who vote, then it changes the way in which democracy works. So Michel Houellebecq wrote a novel about that, imagining what would happen in France if the Muslims there created a Muslim party. Is that something that we're likely to see or to worry about, or is it always simply going to be a political alliance between the old left and the new Muslim presence?
Well, I haven't seen evidence of that yet. On the last census, Garrett, it's 6.5% of the population that is Muslim. That is a significant minority. I mean, it's definitely a meaningful chunk that influences elections, as we just sort of discussed, and influences voters. And it does mean that, you know, contemporary political parties are keen to garner the Islamic vote because they see it as significant and they're playing to it. Like I said, they've adopted Islamic ideas, like the definition of Islamophobia and things. So it is in our country quite hard to set up a political party that has any success beyond sort of remaining a sort of minority party that campaigns on fringe issues. I haven't seen evidence of that yet, but nevertheless, Islam is massively affecting our culture. It is silencing criticism of it. You saw, even was it this year, the film about the life of Muhammad's wife, I think it was, Lady of Heaven, and it was banned because of Islamic protests. This is effectively Islamic blasphemy law. Then you've got the dropping of the Quran in the school in Wakefield. A pupil, you know, dropped or had knocked out of his hand a book that he had purchased. It was his own book, happened to be a Quran, got slightly scuffed. And my goodness, the fuss, the police got involved. I mean, what is that? Because it's a Quran, you know, therefore this is effectively Islamic blasphemy law again, that you don't drop a Quran in a school, even if it's your own copy, because it's kind of regarded as sacred in our community in Britain. This is very, very disturbing and very shocking, I think. Gavin, so we are, you know, we have kind of very close to a de facto Islamic blasphemy situation here. There's no film producers that are going to produce a film about Islam now because they know that nobody will, you know, it'll get boycotted and they won't make any money in the UK. There's no publishing house that will publish a novel like The Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie 30 years ago because they know there'll be so many protests and so much backlash, the cost won't be worth it, they won't do it. And Islamic art, they won't print as well. I've got a copy of the Little Book of Islam at Oxford University Press. It's got a blank page in there. And the little note saying, we used to have an image of this famous painting that was regarded as a historic masterpiece, but some people can play this blasphemous, and therefore we stopped printing it in this book. In other words, Oxford University Press implementing an Islamic blasphemy code, which is quite an extreme code because most Muslims wouldn't view that as blasphemous. Yeah, this is where we are in this country. Companies, organizations, political parties, local councils are adopting Islamic blasphemy codes, and this is affecting our whole culture and our whole politics, and people are very scared to say something about it.
Should the church's response be not so much as to trying to compete with Islam for the minds and the hearts of our secular neighbors, but to put all its weight behind defending freedom of speech? I mean, if we have freedom of speech, then certain conversations can take place. We can at least say the Gospels are as or more attractive than the Quran, Jesus is as or more attractive than Muhammad. But without freedom of speech, we can't do any of those things. And the thought of having a criminal charge hanging over our heads is going to restrain and frighten a lot of people. Why isn't the church more, not just a church, but fellow travellers, liberal fellow travellers, why aren't they more energetically pursuing our rights of freedom of speech in the face of an effective blasphemy law?
Well, there are some, of course, Gavin. I mean, the Free Speech Union is out there and is campaigning about free speech in this whole area and well, you know, in lots of areas, but including in relation to Islam and all the other ideologies we've talked about. But you're right, the church doesn't seem to be very vocal about this. As a Christian concern, we're very vocal about this and constantly campaigning about it, constantly talking about the importance of it. But not many people are. And I think that perhaps we've lost really in culture largely the importance of free speech. We've had political correctness now as something that's affected our culture for what, 30 years plus? People have adopted this idea, I need to be careful what I say because it's explicitly incorrect to say something, explicitly incorrect to say other things. So they keep quiet, they don't say what they really think. And they now that's kind of normalized in our culture. Therefore, people who are like 30 years old, they've grown up with that. That's their normal experience. You don't really say what you think. You're careful about what you say. If you don't want to be jumped on as being politically correct or saying something that is, you know, frowned on by culture, they go to work, they keep themselves to themselves. They don't air any opinions that somebody might possibly be offended by. And we've lost this idea of free speech and the importance of it and the ability to have rational debate about things that somebody might find offensive. And the idea that it's terrible to offend somebody, even when speaking the truth, you know, and therefore, you know, you don't speak the truth because it might offend somebody, means that we've lost this concept of free speech in our society, I'm afraid.
I think it's one of the things that keeps on giving me a sense that in this respect, at the least, there's a replay of the 1930s, this slow erosion of the freedom of the capacity to express yourself. I was very impressed once when I met an evangelical pastor who had been a member of Hezbollah and indeed been an Islamic terrorist who killed for Mohammed outside this country. He had a vision of Jesus in his prison and became a Christian. And although you hear about these things apocryphally, when you meet somebody and talk to somebody who's had that kind of experience and had their lives turned round, it brings a different perspective to it. Miss Tash is very effective. I've seen her at Speaker's Corner, and I've been astonished at her bravery and courage, but also astonished at the determination of violent men both to shut her up and, it appears, to try and kill her. Are we going to need to depend upon Muslim converts to carry this battle to a somnolent society that's lost its sense of values? If the church won't do it, will post-Muslim Christians do it?
Well, Muslim converts do tend to, you know, be very clear about the issues with Islam. They've experienced it themselves. They've lived under its lie for too long, and they are much more prepared to be blunt and upfront about it than some of the rest of us are. So that is the experience, and that is often what you see, Gavin. And so, but I think that more generally, Gavin, Muslims put us to shame, don't they, as Christians, because they are bold and confident and unashamed. You don't see Muslims worrying about being politically correct. You just don't see it. Christians are all the time worried about being politically correct and afraid and don't want to offend anybody or want to be loving and nice and gentle and kind. Oh, you know, don't offend somebody. You know, just be nice and meek and gentle. There's a place for that a bit. But my goodness, I mean, Jesus was blunt. Jesus, read Matthew 23. I mean, Jesus was very blunt at certain times and prepared to, you know, clearly offend. In fact, the disciples complained to him at one point. Don't you realize the Pharisees are offended by what you're saying? You know, they were worried about what Jesus was saying. And if we're going to be a bit more like Jesus, we actually, in this sense, need to be a bit more like Muslims and unafraid to speak our minds and say what is true and be prepared to offend in the name of love, in the name of truth, in order to speak the truth, which is actually what will set people free and what will get people into the kingdom. So I think that there's a sense in which Islam is out there to shame the church and does shame the church to be more bold and more courageous and more willing to criticize the culture and say, no, this is not what's God's way, without violence, without threats. This is what we should be doing.
And to act on its own beliefs. Well, Tim Depp, you've been very forthright and very informed. Thank you very much. Thanks for all the work that you do to defend Christians who find themselves cancelled either by the secularists or by on account of accusations of Islamophobia. You're an inspiration to us all, and thank you for talking to us today. It's been really very informative. Bless you.
Thank you, Gavin.